This is the web stream of KBOO Portland. KBOO is 100% community supported. If you have not yet become a member, go to the website kboo.fm and click on the tip jar.
Rocky Horror Picture Show every Saturday at midnight, as well as the monthly KBOO Movie Night. The Clinton Street Theater is located at the corner of Southeast Clinton and 26th in Portland. Schedule and information at 503-238-5588 or cstpdx.com.
Hello, you're listening to KBOO Radio, your member-supported community radio station, 90.7 FM in Portland, Oregon. My name is Gene Bradley, and our guest today is Craig Johnson, famous author.
Hey, Gene, how are you?
I'm doing well, thanks. Welcome to KBOO.
Good to be here.
Craig's new book, Serpent's Tooth, has just been published by Viking Press, and we're going to talk to him a little bit about that today. Now, it's your ninth novel in the Walter Longmire mystery series. In addition to all the fans you have of your books, you also have a large new audience. 2012 was the first season of a TV series based on your books called Longmire. Mm-hmm. It's on the A&E Network. And I read that the first episode had 4 million viewers.
Yeah, and that was actual live viewers, not even including the DVR folks and all that. I guess it was actually the highest rated scripted drama in A&E's network history, which comes as kind of a surprise for a TV show that's based on a sheriff's department in the least populated county in the least populated state in America. Not bad at all.
That must be a little disorienting for somebody who's used to print sales.
It's very disorienting. Like, I got to tell you, like, I mean, you know, it's all a little wild for me like that, because I have to admit that, you know, I mean, there are 22-and-a-half story, you know, billboards down there on Sunset Boulevard of Walt's face, you know, and people always ask me, they say, well, what's it like to have, you know, characters from your books, you know, suddenly come alive? And I always acquainted with, you know, having a house plant in your house for like 7 or 8 years and then getting up one morning and then having things start talking to you. You know, so it's very wonderful, but a little alarming at the same time. So
at this point, I mean, you've been recognized by Publishers Weekly, Library Journal, Western Writers of America, Wyoming Historical Society, and now 4 million-plus viewers. How do you describe yourself at this point?
Oh, I'm just a cowboy writer from U-Cross, Wyoming, population 25, the crown jewel of the UCLA area, U-Cross, Claremont, Leiter, and Arvada, right up there at the base of the Bighorn Mountains, you know, at the Montana-Wyoming border. And I don't know. I mean, you always ask writers, you know, you always ask them, say, you know, well, you know, how did you start? Like, and I think if they're all honest, they always had the same, you know, the same answer to that question, which is, this ran out of excuses. And for me, that was pretty much the case. I had this idea about, you know, this young woman who is a product of fetal alcohol syndrome, who's Northern Cheyenne, and she's taken into a basement and abused by these four, you know, local, you know, football players like that in this this town that is adjacent to the Indian reservation, and then somebody starts dispatching these young men, you know, with a 45-70 Sharps Buffalo rifle, and basically what happens is it kind of lands in my protagonist Walt Longmire's lap, you know, and he's not, you know, the usual protagonist of a lot of crime fiction. I mean, you know, generally the 6'2" of twisted steel and sex appeal, every woman wanted them, every man feared them, they could kill anyone with a #2 Ticonderoga pencil in 3.2 seconds. And I have to admit, I hate that character. It's my least favorite character in all of literature. And Walt's more of what I tend to refer to as over. He tends to be, he's overage, he's overweight, he's overly depressed, but, you know, he's still a good guy. He still gets up in the morning and still tries to get the job done. And to me, that's true heroism.
Now, you wrote this first book, and it was published in 2004. Mm-hmm. And you've been writing about Walt Longmire ever since, sheriff of Absaroka County.
Absaroka County. Like, that's very good. Like, the word itself is Absarka, like that, which is a crow word that the crow use for themselves, and it's the children of the long-beaked bird. And but I was talking to a buddy of mine, Marcus Red Thunder, up on the Northern Cheyenne Reservation, and I said, you know, I think I'm going to call it Absarka County because I wanted to have a fictitious county.
Right.
I was having, you know, I didn't want people thinking I was writing documentaries like it, so I kind of fell back on the Faulkner, you know, school of, you know, creating a county. So in a state of 23 counties, I came up with a 24th. Like, and I told him, I said, Marcus, I think I'm going to do this thing. I'm going to call it Absarka County. Like, and he pauses for a second. He goes, is it mostly going to be white people in the county? And I said, yeah, it probably is. And he said, well, they would would mispronounce it as Absaroka County land. So,
well, I guess
that's how it became.
There we go. Well, you've been writing about this guy since 2004. You got 9 novels, 12 books altogether. Mm-hmm. He's the main mover of all your stories. Tell us a little bit more about him. What his background is.
I think he's, you know, in many ways like that. You know, he's kind of like in the direct lineage, you know, of the Gene Autrys and the Roy Rogers and all this kind of thing. I mean, he kind of, you know, he lives by, you know, that cowboy code, but it's just that he's doing it in a much more complex world. I mean, you know, Roy Rogers never had to kick the door down of a trailer house as was being used as a meth lab. Like it. So, you know, even though I think that would lead to some really interesting songs by Roy, but it's one of those things where, you know, it's you know, a lot of the quintessential elements of a romantic, you know, epic American Western, but, you know, set against the backdrop of a much more cosmopolitan and much more complex, you know, contemporary setting.
Now, you call him a sadder but wiser sheriff.
I do. I do tend to call him a sadder but wiser sheriff. I mean, he's just not a spring chicken, you know, and he's got a lot of difficulties in his life, you know. I mean, you know, Walt was he went and played football for USC, was an interior lineman like that, and then, you know, graduated, lost his deferment, and got shipped off to Vietnam, which was, I think, a major turning point in his life. I don't think he ever really saw himself as, you know, as carrying a gun and standing behind a badge for the majority of his life, but he's found himself there. And one of the things I like about him is that, you know, I very seriously, you know, I contemplated it a great deal like that before I, you know, started putting together components of the character, in the sense that, you know, I knew I wanted him to be a sheriff because, I don't know, a lot of people are maybe not aware of it or not like that, but, you know, sheriffs are the only elected law enforcement officials in the United States. And so, you know, what you end up being is not only a policeman, but a politician, you know, and the reason for that is not only was it quintessentially, you know, the form of law enforcement in the frontier West, like that, in this romantic epic West that I'm portraying, but it's also it meant that the character would be connected, you know, to the society and to the culture. Mm-hmm. I didn't want him to be one of those lone wolf characters, like I was, you know, discussing before, that kills off 27 people by the time the book is over with. I can't do that because my town only has 25 people in it. Like that. But I really kind of wanted him to be, you know, more connected, you know, to his constituency, and be more emblematic of, you know, the laws and the values, you know, that they saw fit, you know, to be enforced. You know, to me, that was much more important, you know, to the books. I mean, in essence, you know, the books, especially The Cold Dish, the first book, you know, as a kind of a balancing act, you know, between the two cultures, you know, that make up, you know, the High Plains, where it is that I live. The two major cultures are, you know, the white mainstream culture, and then the reservation culture, the native culture, like that, the Indian culture. And I do say Indian, I don't say Native American, because all of my Northern Cheyenne friends make fun of me when I try and be politically correct and say, you know, Native American. They look at me and they say, "Where were you born?" And I say, "Well, I was born here in America." "So you would be a Native American too then, wouldn't you?" So.
Let me digress for a second here. Now, Walt Longmire is coming back home from Vietnam.
He's been
settling back home. He's the son.
Well, he
of
has
Blacks
for quite some time. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. But you came to Wyoming by a different path. Can you talk a little bit about that?
You know, how I got to Wyoming was, I was delivering horses down from up in Montana. I was working for a rancher up there, and I was in my 20s, like that. And you know, I arrived down there, and there was supposedly some guy was coming up from Oklahoma City that was going to pick up the horses. And so I get there, and the guy wasn't there, like that. And so I went over, and there was a little bar there, you know, called the U-Turn Inn, which was, you know, about all there was. There was a post office, the little bar, which is kind of a general mercantile too, like that. And then I went over and got on the payphone, like that, and I call up this rancher I was working for in Montana, and I said, you know, "He's not here. What do you want me to do?" Like that, you know. And he said, "Well, you know, he'll be along any minute. He hasn't left yet." And I said, "From Oklahoma City, he hasn't left yet?" Like that. And he said, "Well, you know, no need to get all upset about it." He said, "Just go over like that and find some idiot bales," which are the 70-pound, you know, hay bales. Like that. He said, "Find some of those from one of the local ranchers, feed the horses with, and then just, you know, buck it up, you know, from Clear Creek, and fill up that bathtub that's there, you know, at the public corral," like that, which kind of gives you an idea of what my town is like. You know, there isn't any payphone anymore, but there still is a public corral, I have to admit. But I did that, and I spent, you know, 3 marvelous days in U-Cross, Wyoming, sleeping up on top of the horse trailer, you know, using my saddle, you know, for a pillow and a nice scratchy, you know, wool blanket, and just looking up at the sky and what I guess the crow refer to as the Milky Way galaxy. You look back through the thick part of that, you know, from horizon to horizon in that part of the world, like that, and it's it looks almost like a hammock is what it looks like of stars like that. And the crow had this really great phrase that they use for it. It's called the hanging road. And when you go on, you know, to the next level, the next world, like that, you take the hanging road to get there.
Oh.
And the place just spoke to me. It just seemed like, you know, such a marvelous, you know, magnificent place. And it really kind of is a little bit of a hidden world, because it's a mountain range, the Bighorn Mountains, which kind of stretch out, you know, from the very tip up there, just barely into Montana, and then swing down into about half of Wyoming like that. But most people are in such a hurry to get to the Black Hills over in South Dakota, or Yellowstone over in the western part of our state, like that, you know, our little part's almost forgotten. And it's got like 189,000 square miles of, you know, wilderness area where, you know, no motor vehicles are allowed in, you know, no campsites, no nothing. I mean, if you want to go in there, you do it the old-fashioned way, leather, either, you know, on your hiking boots or, you know, on a saddle, either way, like that. And, you know, places like that are getting harder and harder to find.
Oh,
I'm
sure.
Kind of proud of it. And it's fun for me to display, you know, that place, like that, and try and, you know, bring it across as much as I possibly can. Because I think that, you know, if you're going to write about a place that you love, one of the things that, you know, that it does demand of you is an honesty, you know. And it's not a perfect place like that, but it's pretty magnificent and it's pretty wonderful. And I really kind of like bringing it to the reader's attention.
So you first visited there in the 1980s, and in 1990 you bought some land there. By 1992 you had a log cabin kit delivered to your property with a manual.
Well, yeah,
and you started
kit
out.
Kit is kind of a euphemism. Kit, it means a pile of logs, is what it means.
They weren't like numbered, I understand.
No, they were not. Like it's kind of a wide open proposition there. Like that, you know, anything you fine tune with a chainsaw, you figure is probably you know, got to have a certain amount of leeway with like that. But I bought the property and I had one of those fathers, you know, who felt you were slave labor until you were an adult, you know, and could escape like that. And so I had learned, you know, basic construction. I'd never built any log cabins or anything like that, but I just, you know, I knew that's what I wanted to build. Like that. And I built that first, you know, that first part of the ranch, a little cabin about 24 by 36, and then added on to it, like that, and built the corrals, like that, and the barns and the shops and everything else like that. So, yeah, I built the entire ranch myself.
Now, you've been quoted as saying that building that log cabin taught you how to be a writer. You got a blue-collar school of writing.
Yeah. I tell you what, I was not the most patient young man, you know, and I don't think that, you know, they say that, you know, revolution, you know, is the industry of young men. Like, and I don't know if writing novels is, though. So I think I had to learn a little bit of patience. You know, I didn't really have a lot of tolerance for anything that, you know, couldn't be done over a 3-day weekend. And so I had to get a little age under my belt, you know, and learn a little bit of patience like that. And I'll tell you what, there's nothing like pouring concrete and stacking logs, you know, from sun up till sundown like that to kind of teach you a little bit of patience along the way.
You started this first book, the first couple chapters of what turned out to be your first book. You started this when it started getting rainy and you ran out of money. And then you, according to the story, you put it in a drawer.
No, not rain. It was snow.
No, okay. There you go. And you put it in a drawer, and you pull it, you open the drawer, look at it every once in a while, and it 12 years later,
yeah,
you took it
yeah.
out. And
it was
got
actually
going
nine
on?
And a half, nine,
nine
and a
half
years
later.
Okay. Like it was one of those things where I got started on it, and I started the book, and the two first chapters were just so horrible, I couldn't bear to look at them anymore. Like it, and I thought, well, what's wrong with this? Why is it as bad as it is? And I thought, you know what? You don't know enough about sheriffing is the problem. Like it, and so I thought, well, what I better do then is, you know, first person, you know, primary research material. You're a journalist. You know about this type of thing. You know, and there's nothing more seductive in the English language than the phrase "Tell me a little about yourself." You know, and so I drove into the sheriff's office in Johnson County there. Like that, and went in and introduced myself to the sheriff and told him my name's Craig Johnson. I got a little ranch out in U-Cross, and you know, I'm writing this murder mystery about a Wyoming sheriff. And after a while, he agreed to actually help me, like that you know, he would actually work the book like a case. And that's how I got started on the cold dish. Well, I was so relieved that I'd solved that problem that I went back out to the ranch and started, you know, adding, you know, buildings and building corrals and doing all this kind of stuff. And so finally what happened was I finally finished up, and everything was pretty much done at the ranch, and everything was up and running. And I pulled open that third drawer down on the right-hand side, and you know, those two lonely little chapters were looking up at me, and 9.5 years had gone by. And I hadn't worked up enough nerve to go in and talk to the sheriff, even though I'd known he was still the sheriff because I'd voted for him 3 times. And so I actually was going into town to put gas in my truck. And so I was putting gas in my truck at the Texaco station, and this sheriff's cruiser pulls in on the other side of the pump island. This guy gets out, and he tips his hat back, you know, and he drops his sunglasses down. He's giving me a look, you know, which in law enforcement circles, you know, conveys, what did I arrest you for and when was it? Like that. And so I look at him, and I stuck out my hand, and I said, "Sheriff Kirkpatrick, you're probably not going to remember me." And he goes, "Your name's Craig Johnson. You're the one that's writing the, you know, you're the one that's got the little ranch out near U-Cross. You're the one that's writing the murder mystery about the Wyoming sheriff." And I looked at him. This was a 10-minute conversation from, you know, almost 10 years previous. And I said, "That is absolutely amazing." And he looks back at me and he goes, Yeah, if you don't mind me saying so, this book is going kind of slow." So, you know, that pissed me off enough to where I actually sat down and I started writing the rest of The Cold Dish. And then Catherine Court and Penguin and Viking got a hold of me and they said, "You know what, we think, you know, that you should consider, you know, doing some more of these." And that's how the Walt Longmire series began.
Now, the first book was published in 2004, and since then you put out about a book a year.
A book a year, yeah. As a matter of fact, there's going to be 2 books this year.
That's right. Another one coming up.
Yeah.
We're looking forward to that.
It was kind of an accidental book. It was supposed to be a short story, but after, you know, 4 days, it was 80 pages long. And I said, you know, I called them back in New York, and I said, "Well, I don't know what you want to do with this." And they said, "Well, how long do you think it's going to be?" And I said, "Well, I think it's going to be about half the size of one of the books." And they said, "You know what? We'll put it out as a novella, a hardbound novella."
Right.
October. So October 17th, Spirit of Steamboat, you know, we'll hit the shelves.
I saw that on the list. I said, "Hey, wait a minute."
I know.
Very impressive.
Hey.
So tell us a little bit about this new book in front of us here.
New book is not, in some ways it's very different from all the others. In some ways it's not very different at all. Like that, generally the books tend to come from newspaper articles. Like that, what I'll do is I'll stumble across a newspaper article there in Wyoming or Montana, and I'll see something like that I think, you know, might work as a Walt Longmire catalyst, you know. And so this one wasn't that different. I discovered that there had actually been one of the Warren Jeffs fundamentalist, you know, polygamy splinter group compounds over in Custer County, South Dakota. And there were a couple of these lost boys, which are these young teenage boys that are kind of booted out on trumped up charges, you know, from these compounds, basically, you know, because the older men want access to more and younger, you know, women. And so as hideous as that is, like, you know, these poor young men are out there. And they have no resources. They have no abilities. This is a strange new world to them. They have no idea. Some of them have never even seen a television before in their lives. And so it just dawned on me that, you know, this would be an interesting situation to have Walt land in his lap, you know. And so what happens is, of course, is he comes across Cord Lanier, like that, one of these lost boys. And it seems like a social case at first, like that. But then when we discover that his mother, his advocate within this group, is actually missing, and no one seems to be having some straight answers as to where it is she might be, then it kind of transfers over to being something of a criminal case. And that involves the good sheriff at that point.
And it leads to all kinds of...
It does. Okay.
As many books complicated. As I've read, it was just the last 20 pages were quite enthralling. I was
totally there with you.
Well, it was just a wonderful book. Now, every one of your books, I think, looking back, has had some real topical tie-in or underlying incident kind of going on there.
Well, you know, I'm firmly of the belief that, like, you know, one of the things that, you know, if you base them off of, you know, newspaper articles or, you know, headlines that are in the news, you know, especially in the rural American West, what that kind of does is it kind of keeps the books grounded in a reality, you know, so that, you know, Walt is, you know, is dealing with the same things that, you know, that rural sheriffs are dealing with here in Oregon, you know, everywhere across the American West. And I think it keeps him grounded. I don't ever want to write books where Walt is chasing Al-Qaeda in Crook County, or, you know, Walt's on a cruise ship, or Walt's on a skateboard or something like that. I want him dealing with the realities, you know, of the American West, like that. And I'm also firmly of the belief that, you know, if you're not writing a book that's not going to offend anybody, then you're not writing a book worth reading anyway, like that. And so, you know, in some small way, you know, the book should kind of offend somebody all along the way.
Well, it's wonderful because it's not just your Western story. I mean, it really ties into the modern things that everybody has to deal with right there in what we imagine to be a rural setting, but it's just exactly as complicated as Philadelphia.
Absolutely. Oh, absolutely.
Which you've also written about.
I have. I think that, you know, that there's just so much to work with there. That and like I said, you know, I mean, it's, you know, if you're going to show the beauty and you're going to show the wonder and you're going to show all of that, well, you better show the scars and you better show the warts and you better show all of the bad stuff too, like that, because the worst thing that could ever happen would be if somebody were to jump on a plane here in Portland, look at and fly into, that northern portion of Wyoming there at the base of the Bighorn Mountains and look, get out of the plane and look around and go, this is nothing at all like what Craig Johnson has in his book. That would be the most horrible thing that could ever possibly happen. You know, I want them to feel like they know these characters, they know this place, they know this society, this culture, all of this, and I feel after 9 books, you know, I've given them a possibility of being able to do that.
You've given us all a great education of what it's like to be in that place. Not
well,
really,
you,
I'm
sir.
Serious
thank
because
you.
You know, your description of landscape and the weather and how people are reacting and stuff. You've also done a wonderful job of over the course of these books talking about the Northern Cheyenne and the reservation. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Well, these are my neighbors. You know, these are my friends. Look at to leave them out of the books. You know, whenever I read a contemporary American novel that takes place in the West, I'm always kind of shocked, you know, whenever there is no Native involvement at all like that. And granted, you know, I mean, my ranch is, you know, just, you know, 40 minutes south, you know, of both the Northern Cheyenne and the Crow Reservation. And so, you know, these are amazing people. You know, I mean, even if I wanted to leave them out, I don't think I could, you know, because they're just absolutely magnificent people. They're just so intelligent, so insightful, and so funny. I mean, I'm firmly of the belief, like, the books are very popular up on the Crow and the Northern Cheyenne reservations, and one of the reasons I think that is because I tend to approach those characters as people first, you know, and then, you know, whenever I deal with, you know, whatever the tribal delineation might be or anything like that, you know, comes afterwards. Like, but the passion, you know, the desires, the fears are all the same as a lot of us. Like, and so, you know, for me, it's important to have that kind of detail in there. And, you know, it's you know, I spoke about the humor there because I don't think that there's ever been a group of individuals that's been more maligned as not having a sense of humor than the American Indian. I mean, you know, we've all grown up with that stereotype, cliched image of, like, you know, the cigar store Indian with the, you know, the hand raised and how, you know, and all of that. Like that. And I've got to tell you that, you know, all of the Indians that I know are hilarious. Like, they've got incredible senses of humor, incredible senses of irony. You know, every conversation is at least running on about 17 different levels, and if you don't know what those levels are, I can guarantee you will be the butt of that humor. Like that. And so for me, you know, it's really kind of important to make sure that fully dimensionalized, you know, type of person, you know, really gets, you know, their fair share. Like that. I mean, you know, one classic example of that is my buddy Marcus Red Thunder, like that, who's the bassist for Henry. I discovered that there had been a Mennonite church up on the Northern Cheyenne Res, and the church was gone, but the foundation was still there. But I was just, you know, kind of interested by that, you know, when I was doing research for the second book, Death Without Company. And I asked him, I said, you know, Marcus, you know, Mennonites on the Res? And all he did was look up and go, "It didn't take." That's all he said.
Well, you do a great deal through your books to show us what daily life on the reservation is and the things that these people have to cope with, and it's a marvelous job. That,
well, it's not an easy life. It's a difficult situation, like in so many different ways. Like, you know, going beyond, you know, all of the things like that are against these people. I think it's, you know, and I think it might even be in the first book, The Cold Dish, you know, where Walt talks about the numbers. You know, when he rolls onto the res, you know, the thing that he sees is the numbers for the unemployment, the numbers for the alcoholism, the diabetes, you know, all of these things, you know, domestic violence and all these things. And he said, but the trick is you can't let these numbers get in the way of seeing the people. Mm-hmm. You have to see them as people. You can't see them as numbers.
Right.
And I think that that's really kind of essential, you know, in any kind of a situation, you know, to try and see past, you know, all of the factors, you know, that are, you know, those so readily available, and try and see the human beings that are underneath that.
Another of the really beautiful things about your series is the way the...
You keep talking like that. We can just do this conversation all night long.
That sounds good. All right. It's a supporting cast. I feel, as a reader, that I have really gotten to know a whole bunch about the supporting cast over time. And you tell us a little bit more about, you know, various people in various books, and you really get at the 8th or 9th book, you really feel like you know these people.
Oh, absolutely, and that's one of the joys of writing the books is, you know, a series of books at least, like that, in the sense that, you know, you really do develop a kind of a high context kind of relationship with the reader, so that they do know the characters, sometimes even better than I do, like that. And the wonderful thing about that is you get to have all those inside jokes. You get to have all those inside bits of information, you know, as you float along with the characters. And, you know, I think it was Steinbeck that once said, you know, you need to be able to take even the most minor character in your book and write an entire series of novels about them. And I'm firmly of that belief. Like, I don't believe in throwaway characters. I think that, you know, each character is there, you know, for a very specific reason. I think that they're for an important reason. And for me, it's always going to be an ensemble kind of a situation. Even though the books are written in first person, you know, you're kind of in Walt's head, you know, for 350, 400 pages like that. And some people have said, you know, that, well, there's not as much humor, you know, in the television show as there is in the books. And that's probably true like that. But I think what they tend to not realize is that, you know, you're in Walt's head, so an awful lot of his observations, you know, an awful lot of, you know, his insights, you know, tend to be the tone of the humor of the books.
Right.
And, you know, but even though you've got that kind of like strong, you know, protagonist, you know, character, you know, they really are surrounded by, you know, as many, you know, exotic, you know, and interesting and entertaining characters as you can possibly have. Like, in many ways, you know, it was a construction in the sense that, you know, I knew that the books were going to have a really strong masculine narrative as far as that was concerned. Like, and so I knew that I really needed a number of really strong, you know, interesting, you know, intelligent female characters like that. And so what you might notice is there are an awful, you know, lot of female characters within the books because they're kind of responsible for keeping Walt alive. He's kind of like a wounded, you know, he's kind of damaged goods, you know. And so, you know, thank goodness he does have this, you know, this group, you know, what I tend to refer to as a pride of lionesses around him to make sure that he's safe and okay.
Well, it's his dispatcher and the person who runs the Busy Bee Cafe.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Certainly his deputy.
They all have responsibilities.
They all keep him propped up and keep him on the straight and narrow. It's a marvelous production.
You know, there's nothing that men need more and probably are thankful less of like that than the female help that they need along the lines.
Well, there you go. Now, you are in the midst of a three-month, what you call a patrol. You go on to 68 different sites, different 21 states.
I am.
And eventually, you're going to get home. Do you have more stories to tell about
these folks?
I actually
do. Yeah, I'm about 13 chapters into the next book.
Goodness.
And I've got file folders of all the newspaper articles and stories that people have emailed me, all these type of things like that I've got, you know. And the great thing about that is I'll drop dead before I get a chance to write all of the stories that I have for Walt. I mean, being with a publisher like Viking Penguin is kind of wonderful because it's more of a literary press. So they really don't put any kind of pressures on me as far as, you know, what kind of books I should write or how I should write them. Every one of the contracts for the Walt books, all it says is it must be a mystery and have Walt Longmire in it. Well, that leaves me a lot of leeway to get into trouble, you know, and do a lot of stuff. And that's, you know, one of the reasons why I think that you know, I'm having just as much fun, if not more fun nowadays writing the books than I did when I started out.
Well, that's great. Well, I surely want to thank you for making time and coming over and talking to us at KBOO Radio today.
It's
been a big thrill.
My pleasure.
Your new book, A Serpent's Tooth by Viking Press. If you are new to the series, you're going to have to buy them all because you're going to love them. And if you're a constant fan, then you're going to want to read this new one. So thanks again, Craig Johnson, for visiting with us today.
Thanks. Boy, howdy.
All right. I wish you could see his hat. That's all I can say.
On Thursday, July 18th, from 5:30 to 7 p.m., KBOO will be broadcasting the first town hall meeting called by the nonprofit group Article 5 Convention for Our Children's Future on the issue of the National Defense Budget. Experts on the panel include Dr. Robert Pollan, Dr. Miriam Pemberton, and Colonel Lawrence Wilkerson. Once again, you can tune in on Thursday, July 18th from 5:30 to 7 p.m. on KBOO Portland.
Where is your radio dial on Thursday afternoons from noon until 2? 90.7 FM is the place to be. Twice a month, DJ Charlie presents the World Beat Connection with the hottest Afro-Caribbean sounds in Portland radio land. Reggae, salsa, soca, New Orleans Afro-funk, Haitian compa and rara, and Antillean zouk share the airwaves with African highlife. Afrobeat, Congolese soukous, Malian blues, juju, and South African kwaito, among the other great styles. Traditional and modern expressions are all included. On alternate weeks, check out Top Rankin' Reggae and Dancehall with Shocks of Sheba show, hosted by Teresa and Michelle. Any week, Thursdays at noon is sure to move ya.
Hey, I could listen to that music all day long. That's absolutely terrific. Hi, everyone. Dan Johnson. Welcome to Radio Zine. It's Thursday, the 18th of July, and it is just 11:30 right now. I'd like to introduce you to Andrea Hollander. She is the author of a new book. It is titled Landscape with Female Figure. And Andrea, being somewhat new to the Portland area, has already, in the short time she's been here, become the recipient, 2013 recipient of the Oregon Literary Foundation. And she has a resume a mile long with such distinguished honors. But let me tell you, Andrea, it's great having you in the studio, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Dan, for inviting me.
I want to start off by reading a paragraph on the back of your book, and we're going to use that as sort of a springboard for our conversation. It starts off like this, and it's written by Maxine Kuhman, a distinguished writer in her own right. And she starts off by saying, in Still Life with Jonquils, Hollander says, "The painter knows we bring our own, he